This is the Concealed Carry Podcast, episode number 125. And welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the ConcealedCarry.com network. And I am your host, Riley Bowman. And today, finally, I'm joined again by my compadre, Jacob Paulson.
It's compadre. I like that.
That was good. I'm glad you like it. Glad to have you back.
Yeah.
You know, you decided to, you know, skip town again on me. And I think you're finally, you know, wearing regular clothes. You're out of your jammies.
Yeah. I don't even own jammies, man.
I know you. Anyway, hey folks, today is Memorial Day. Now we're pre-recording this, of course, but we wanted to wish you all a good Memorial Day. Obviously, it's a day, more of a somber holiday, but still, many families across the nation enjoy some time together and have a good time. I know I will be. I should be. Hopefully, at the time you're listening to this, I should be barbecuing, running the grill, having some good eats.
There you go.
Yeah. We'll say a prayer and we'll think of those who died and gave their lives for us and for this country. Some within my family, within my ancestors in particular. So, anyway, how about you, Jacob? What you up to?
Yeah, happy Memorial Day. Well, I also am confident I'll consume grilled meat. And be thinking about, you know, many people who have sacrificed. My grandfather died last year. He was a veteran who lost a leg in World War II. So, you know, I have some family there. My dad's a veteran, so I'll be thinking a lot about all those people who've made those sacrifices. And I'll be tuning into the Outdoor Channel, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, that's funny. That's right. I'd kind of forgotten about that. Before I talk about that, though, I was thinking, that's right, you and I have a very similar connection in that both our grandfathers were veterans, and they both passed away last year. Mm-hmm. So, and my grandfather was just a little bit younger than yours, so he didn't see any... He joined the service as World War II was winding down, but he didn't spend any time overseas during World War II. He actually was sent over to Japan immediately following the war, and then was also... his unit was deployed to Korea, but in a long story I'm not going to go into, he didn't actually go to Korea. So anyway, anyway, we do hope that you have a wonderful Memorial Day. And one of my favorite traditions in our family, we haven't managed to always do it every year, but Fort Logan National Cemetery is not very far from where I live here in the Denver area. And that's a beautiful place to go and just reflect on. I don't know if I've been in any other place that reminds me of just like Arlington National Cemetery. I mean, it looks and feels so similar. And it's a good place to reflect and think on those that gave their life. Mm. Outdoor Channel. That's right. Monday night on the Outdoor Channel. I hate the self-promotion here, but I'm frankly a little bit excited and also somewhat scared. But Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern or 7 p.m. Mountain Time, which is where we're at, is going to air the show American Marksman. And at 9 p.m. Eastern or 7 p.m. Mountain will be the regional coverage, so regional championship coverage of American Marksman. Following that at 9:30 p.m. Eastern, 7:30 Mountain, will be the national championship coverage. And I don't know that you'll see much of me in the regional championship episode, but in the I should be somewhere in there in the national championship. So yeah, that was the competition I had the pleasure of competing in earlier this year and last year too. Last year was regionals and January earlier this year was the nationals. So, and you were there too, Jacob, but you were watching me.
Yeah, I was freezing my butt off. It was so cold. But yeah, phenomenal, cool thing. I mean, I just really enjoyed it, and such great people there too. I think if you get a chance to tune in and watch, you're going to see how awesome our community is, how many great shooters were able to participate. The hosts are really cool. It's just, you know, good people.
Yeah. Yep. Great. Well, before we get too far along here, today's episode is brought to you by Sports Afield. Today we're going to talk about a couple of stories that involve people using guns to defend their lives. and I'm often thinking about how am I going to access my gun quickly, especially during a home invasion type situation. Now, if I'm sitting here at home like I am now, I've got my gun on me. I wear my gun all the time. But in bed at night, it's stored in a quick access safe, much like the Sportsafield line of quick access safes, which are perfect for that task. They will protect your gun very adequately, but yet still allow you to quickly access them in an emergency with a reliable custom programmable 4-button keypad. And also, Sportsafield has a great line of full-size rifle safes. You might check these out as well. Trust this 100-year-old brand. Yes, the same company that has published the Sportsafield magazine since 1887 with your firearm storage and security needs. Go check out the full lineup at concealedcarry.com/sportsafield. And I don't know how long we're going to keep this going, but for a limited time, save 10% with a coupon code. But I'm not going to give that coupon code today. You can go listen to our last episode for that coupon code if you'd like to. If you missed that episode. Yeah, how about that?
Okay, sure.
Next up, training tip. Jacob, you wrote this down, so I'll let you kick it off.
Yeah, so the objective of this training tip is to help you learn how to move and shoot at the same time. Now, most of us are pretty good at walking and chewing gum at the same time, but moving while shooting is something else entirely. And it certainly is one thing to just move in a straightforward motion or a straight rearward motion or to the left or to the right. But most of us in a real self-defense situation, we probably wouldn't be moving in straight lines. We probably have to do some other related things. And so the way this drill would go, and I think there's a myriad of variations, but the general idea is to put an object or two. I'm going to use the example of two objects in your firing line. And then to kind of weave around and through and between those objects, oftentimes in maybe a figure eight, you know, so kind of around one object, in between them, around the other, and back through, and maybe in a figure eight. But the idea is that the whole time you're doing this, you're keeping yourself square on target, firearm extended, and shooting. And you might do a variety of things with this. You might have continue to do this so much that you have to perform reloads while you're doing this. You might have to have somebody call out actual shots and fires and even targets, target one, target two, low ready, high ready, things like that while you're doing this. But the idea is that you keep yourself on target, square on target, and ready to fire or firing while you're moving. And the interesting thing, I remember the first time I did this rally and someone explained it to me and I said, okay, I got this. And I was doing it dry fire. I had a cert pistol using LASR or something. And everything was going pretty good. I was shooting and moving along until I had to reload. And when the reload was called, I froze. Like my feet just stopped moving until I performed the reload, and then I kept moving. And I didn't even know I did it. I think someone else pointed out to me, he's like, hey, you stopped to reload. And I was like, what? Dang it. And so it's little things like that that you might not even realize you do, that the brain just can't process too many things consciously at the same time. And so unless you've trained the subconscious to perform those actions, you're in trouble.
Yeah. That's a really great point. In fact, as you were explaining that, I was thinking if there is ever a time that is even more critical to potentially move while performing shooting functions, it would be at a time of a reload where you are trying to address a threat and now the gun is shot dry. Get the heck out of there as fast as you can while you know what I mean? Like you should be looking for cover or something, because while you're performing that reload, if you're just standing still, you are a wide open target out in the open, and you're doing something that you where you're not able to immediately address that threat. So, and of course, at the very least, get that gun back in the battery as fast as possible. But that is one of the reasons why I enjoy the figure eight drill, because for most people, if you're doing it to where, okay, so most people can actually get to a point where they're like, all right, I'm going to walk around in this figure eight, or I'm going to do this thing or that thing and continue shooting. That's not too complicated. They can figure that out fairly quickly. But like you described, that as soon as you like interrupt that process, because that already your brain has developed the thought process, okay, I'm going to walk like this, I'm going to do this, and all I got to do is have this gun up, sights on target, press trigger, press trigger, press trigger. But as soon as you interrupt that thought process, boom, you're done. and so that's why so many people, they actually will freeze while my gun just did something I wasn't expecting. And even if it, eventually your gun's going to run out of ammo, right? But you're so focused on move, 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 and shoot that suddenly that whole process is just interrupted. So that's why I like doing it, is it shows people, first of all, and that's a very minor thing, but can you imagine what it's actually like being in a real life deadly force encounter where there's so many variables that you can't even plan for in advance. And I think that's just the beginning for many people, that's just the beginning of them realizing, whoa, wait a minute, this actually is a very complicated thing that we're talking about here, about training to use a gun under pressure and so forth. So what I like running the figure eight drill. Now, if you're just alone, all right, run the figure eight drill, walk around, shoot, do your reloads, make sure you continue moving while you're doing all this. But the second thing is, if you have a partner that can call the commands, you know, say like up or something, and so where you're either low ready or high compressed ready, and you're moving, and then as soon as a command is given, you fire a shot. I like that because what the figure eight drill also teaches you is the need and the realization that of firing the gun in less than ideal positions, meaning like you're not perfectly on balance. Mm-hmm. You're not perfectly in that classic either Weaver or isosceles stance. You are maybe even moving backwards, and that's a little bit kind of an awkward thing for a lot of people, as far as like they're not used to shooting a gun like that. Now, by the way, I would advise that you first do something like this with a competent instructor or someone that can at least keep a close eye on you so that you don't trip and fall down and hurt yourself and have guns and things go flailing about. But anyway, so that's one of the reasons I really like it as well, is just teaching to use and fire the gun in less than ideal balanced positions.
It forces cognitive functions as well. And I would say you can do this dry, and probably, you know, as a precursor, also would help with safety. And if you use LASR, you can turn on target call mode and reload mode. And that's it's not maybe as good as having a partner who's calling out a lot of different things, but at least the software can call out which target to shoot at and when you need to run a reload.
That's a great point and a little used function of LASR probably. Although it is one that I do use, just not probably as frequently as I should. That's a great tip. Thanks, Jacob. All right, let's jump into our news stories now. But first, today's episode is also brought to you by Guardian Nation and Mantis X. And so now, first up, first story is out of Denver, meaning it's the 10th Circuit Court, which is based in Denver's Byron White Courthouse, issued a ruling this last week that has potentially wide ramifications for gun owners. In this new story on our Colorado.concealedcarry.com website, it talks about a Mr. Alexander Poller, who was deemed a prohibited firearms possessor following a misdemeanor domestic abuse case. He was found guilty of domestic abuse in 2009 after punching his girlfriend. And because of that, he was not allowed to be in the possession of a firearm. Now, isn't this interesting, Jacob? Because sometimes you see applications, like say for a concealed handgun permit, where asks questions about misdemeanor cases.
Sure.
Specifically looking for domestic violence type issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that's on a lot of applications.
And so this is kind of, like, this is going directly at that point, in that what happened in this ruling is they basically said that, whoa, a state or local government, you know, issue, a misdemeanor crime, even of involving domestic abuse, can override a federally protected, a U.S. Constitution Bill of Rights protected Second Amendment. That's basically what's saying here, right? And what the ruling was is that no, that can't be the case.
Yeah, and I think this is a wake up call for a lot of people. And you know, one thing or another, like I don't think we're trying to weigh in on this particular individual situation, right? Should this guy should Poller, you know, what is his full name? I already forgot.
Alexander
Poller from Wichita, Kansas. Should this man be allowed to own guns? I don't know. I mean, who am I to say, right? Like,
right.
That's not my problem. But I think the question at hand, or the kind of the point of us sharing the story, is because if you have a federal district court who's essentially saying that, you know, in order to have your Second Amendment rights taken away, you have to be convicted of a felony, and it's not enough to be convicted of a local, you know, statutory misdemeanor or something like that. It's got to be a felony.
Yeah. Now, yeah, I appreciate what you said there too, because I was thinking, yeah, we're not condoning punching your girlfriends or your wives or anything like that. So yeah, we're not speaking to that issue. Definitely there's people that would say, yeah, you shouldn't be able to have guns. All right, that's fine, whatever. But I think when you put it in the context of, we're talking about people's Second Amendment right, which, I mean, that's a big deal. So often in today's society, people are trying to make it not seem like it's that big a deal, when it really, in fact, is. The Second Amendment really is a big, big deal. It was one of the first things that found its way into the, I mean, it's number two. Free speech, then right to possess a gun, right? And and so at issue is, should these lesser crimes, and a misdemeanor is very much a lesser crime, should that take away somebody's Second Amendment right for the rest of their life?
Yeah, and that's a question to be determined, but the point is that it's already been answered. The answer is no, it shouldn't. And so whether or not we should change that is a whole different debate, but what's clear is that it doesn't count. That's not good enough. The way that the law is currently written.
And I certainly hope that Mr. Poller has gotten, you know, over his violent tendencies, and chances are he has, I suppose. I mean, I didn't see anywhere where he's been convicted for anything else. Has he? I don't know.
I don't know, and I don't know how long he's been out of jail. I think he was convicted like 20 years, and he pleaded down to 5 or something, and I have no idea. I couldn't tell you.
If he's convicted, if he's going to be sentenced for 20 years, that couldn't be a misdemeanor.
Let's see. Years. I'm sorry. Months. He was facing 24 to 30 months in prison for possessing the gun. Okay, I'm all sorts of mixed up here. So forget I ever said it. But yeah, no, he was charged for having the gun, and he was sentenced for 24 to 30 months. He plead that down, and then he obviously challenged it in court. Gotcha. And that's where we got.
Oh, okay. Well, there you have it.
Confusing.
So an interesting case. And like I said, this for many, I suspect that there's many gun owners or want to be gun owners that maybe couldn't be because of various things that they had done and done in their past that, honestly, when you think about it, might be fairly small in scale compared to the ramifications of losing someone's Second Amendment rights for, you know, the rest of their life. So this is a ruling that could affect a lot of things. I think, you know, hopefully in a positive way. I'll tell you what, I have a personal friend that has been dealing with trying to get his Second Amendment, you know, to get certain things expunged from his record and things so he can get his right to possess a gun back. And he's a good dude. He's changed his life. He did some bad things in the past, but that was, I mean, and I'm talking like 20 years in the past that are still hanging over his head. And we're still denying him certain basic fundamental rights all these years later.
You know, this brings up an interesting point, and this might be a topic of another podcast another day, but, you know, of the 10 major, you know, amendments to the United States Constitution, the Bill of Rights, as we love to call them, you know, very few others have any limitations at all. In order to lose the majority of your 10 constitutional Bill of Rights rights, you pretty much got to go to prison.
Yeah.
The rest of them are pretty dang well unrestricted. I mean, I can't go onto an airplane and, you know, yell bomb. But, you know, otherwise my freedom of speech is pretty unrestricted. You know, my right to not consent to searches and seizures, for example. I mean, the only time I lose that is if I'm in a jail cell. And it's interesting, you know, how much more regulated the Second Amendment is. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. I just, you know, pointing that out as an interesting, you know, relative comparison.
Yep. Yeah, good thought. Now, on to Florida. On our florida.concealedcarry.com site, we published a story. This one's very interesting to me, and it's something that is becoming a lot more frequent in this day and age of technology and having so much information out there online. But just recently, the Florida State Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services announced that 16,000-plus Floridians with concealed carry permits have had their names obtained in a cyber attack over this. It was this past weekend, not the most recent weekend as you're listening to this episode, but the week one before that. That's a little bit unsettling.
Yeah, this is crazy. They say that the attack, the hack, you know, came from an overseas group. That's as specific as they get. And they specifically targeted the online concealed carry permit system. And they got the names of 16,190 concealed carriers. And apparently, from what I understand, as I read through this, is that the breach only affected concealed carry permit holders who have renewed their permit online. So if you have a Florida concealed handgun permit, and you've renewed it online on the Florida's website before, you're probably among the 16,190.
Yeah. And not only was it 16,190 concealed carrier names that were obtained, but also 469 Social Security numbers were also obtained. So that's an even, you know, like, it's one thing, okay, all right, so if they got a hold of my name and they know that I have a permit, that definitely makes a lot of people unsettled. But, oh, they got a hold of my Social Security number? Now I'm really unsettled, because now it's not just a question of, oh, someone knows that I might have a gun in my home, and that is one issue of security. But now it's a potential identity theft issue, where someone can use that Social Security number in malicious ways. Now, the state said that they will give and provide 1 year of credit protection to help monitor any suspicious activity. And I think that's the right thing to do. But I also kind of chuckle, you know, I've had this happen to me twice where, you know, I get notified by some, and actually one of the times was when I was working in the federal government and another government system got breached and my info was compromised in that breach in the federal government, and they're like, well, we're going to give you 1 year of credit protection. Oh, okay, cool. And then it happened again with, I think it was the Home Depot breach or something. Mm-hmm. And same offer, right? And I'm sitting there thinking, and I'm like, you know, these hackers are not dumb. In fact, they're some of the most intelligent people in the world as far as what they're able to do with technology and computers and things. They're probably just going to hang on to that information for like a year. And then, perhaps, you know, like, you know, I'm just suggesting. Anyway, it wouldn't be that big a deal to hang on to that info for a year plus until people are no longer using credit monitoring potentially, and bam, hit them, wham. Anyway, so yeah,
I mean, it's interesting to try and surmise what the objective is here. I mean, it's one thing to get Social Security numbers, like, okay, like, they said no financial info was stolen, but hey, Social Security numbers, there's some value there. I suppose if you're a criminal, you could do stuff with that. But the name of someone who has a permit, I mean, what really can you do with that? I mean, I don't see any criminal value is what I'm trying to say. I mean, bear in mind, guys, we're talking about 16,000 names. There's over 1.5 million permit holders in Florida. So in terms of like the ratio, it's not a significant number. I don't know. I'm just saying, like, I'm not saying that, you know, maybe they could go like target those homes to steal guns from them. So there's some potential criminal intent, but I don't see it as, you know, as bad as it could have been.
Yeah. Now, if you are in Florida listening to this podcast and you're concerned about potentially being one of these breached names and or Social Security numbers, you can contact the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services to speak with them about it. I'm sure they're getting a lot of calls right now, actually, but I encourage you to check into that, and I encourage you to protect yourself. I actually have had some form of credit monitoring for some time now, for me personally, just because this is the world we live in now, where this sort of thing is constantly under attack, whether it's through the vendors that you frequent as a consumer, whether it's the government, whether it's yourself personally doing things online and you screw up somewhere. I think it's a good idea to have credit monitoring in place.
Yep. Good stuff. Yep.
All right. Next up, in Ohio, an Akron, Ohio man accidentally shoots his daughter, who he mistakenly thought was an intruder. I really hate talking about these stories, Jacob. I really, really, really hate these stories. But I feel an obligation to talk about it because, I mean, our goal here at concealedcarry.com is to make people safer, really as, I mean, if you think about it, right, that's at the core of it, whether it's making them safer in terms of like they're more effective at using their firearms to defend themselves, okay, and safer in that regard, or safer, I mean, we're very passionate about making sure people are safe with guns. And this is the sort of thing that should not happen, but yet it does. I mean, this is not the first time we've talked about a story like this, is it?
No. They do happen more often than they should. I remember in 2015, we had three of these incidents happen here in Colorado. It's just one of those heartbreaking kinds of things. Now, I will just quickly say out loud, because in case you're having a hard time listening to this, the good news on this one is daughter survived.
Yeah, but there are many situations where the child or family member doesn't. And in fact, there was just recently, a few weeks ago, almost very similar, you know, almost an identical story where the family member did not pull through. But so here's the situation. Carrie Beaver, I don't know, the 42-year-old Akron resident, he was home last Thursday morning when he heard someone at the front door of his house. At the time, he believed that his daughter was at a friend's home house sitting. So there was nobody he expected to be coming over. However, unbeknownst to him, his 22-year-old daughter was on the other side of the door trying to get back into the house. During this time, Carrie had already retrieved a loaded firearm from his kitchen and upon grabbing it, called out to see who was at the front door. There was no response. Suddenly, without response, his daughter, who according to police report, Carrie described as nothing more than a shadowy figure, continued to make her way into the house. Unfortunately, as soon as the front door opened and with no knowledge of who it was, Carrie fired a shot without hesitation. It was only after the scream of his daughter did he know the mistake he had made. His daughter lay there bleeding and screaming on the floor with a bullet lodged in the right side of her abdomen. Her shocked father now had to spring into action to rectify his mistake and save her life. He called 911, told the dispatcher that his daughter was shot. And paramedics rushed to the scene, and thankfully, like we said, that she's going to make a recovery. But she's very lucky, he's very lucky in that she's going to pull through this. Besides the luck that I just mentioned, I think he did not do... I don't think he did the right thing here, do you? What do you think, Jacob?
No, but I also think this is a complicated situation, and one that, you know, we could very quickly and easily in our Monday quarterback chairs point at and say, hey, you screwed up, dude. But I don't think it's that far. I know I say this a lot, and a lot of you listeners are like, oh, here goes Jacob again. I don't think it's that far-fetched to believe this could happen to any one of us. And I don't mean that all of us would screw up and make bad decisions, but that we could find ourselves in a similar situation where very little things would make all the difference. And so you need to actually stop and pause and think about this. You know, he hears a noise, someone's at the door, he calls out, the person's on the other side of a door, they probably don't hear him. That just the way that kind of thing goes. And then all of a sudden now he's in a situation where he can see the door from where he's at, the door's opening, a shadowy figure is coming through, and that's, you know, boom, now you got to make some decisions. Do you call out again? Do you make another verbal command? Do you retreat into the home somewhere? Do you fire? You know, what are you going to do? And in this case, in that moment, and that's the moment that I think is we're talking about, he made the wrong decision, which in his case was fire.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of things, you know, or ways we can prevent this sort of thing from happening. Number one, I think if you have family members that live at your home or frequent your home, it's important to talk to them about your security plan. And if your security plan includes, hey, if there's ever a time that somebody is trying to come into the home at an unexpected time, there's a good chance they're going to get shot, right? And meaning that if this is my daughter, probably what, especially now having just shot her, going forward, if you're assuming you're able to repair that relationship, and you know, the talk that would be had, I think, is, you know what, the next time, you know, you come over to the house and you're trying to get into the house at a time that maybe mom and dad is not expecting you to be there or to be coming, you might want to give us a heads up, like give us a phone call, send us a text message. Hey, mom, dad, hey, I'm coming over, I'm coming back, I'm coming in, or whatever. That way there's no chance for that mistaken identity. Number two is identify your target for crying out loud. Right?
Yeah. Like, how about a light switch? You know, like, yes. Hey, someone's coming through that door. Maybe I should turn on some lights because A, if it's a real intruder, that's going to be a deterrent. And B, I'm going to be able to identify what I'm shooting at.
You cannot identify your target if you fire as soon as the door springs open. And I know this is an uncomfortable position to be in because it's like, holy cow. I mean, the door just got kicked open, let's say. All right. Now, that's not what happened here necessarily. But let's say the door gets kicked open. Well, okay, maybe that's not exactly apples to apples here because if the door is kicked open, then that's probably not my son or somebody. But if the door opens up, you have to have a brief moment there of who is that, okay? And you know, before pressing the trigger, before bringing the gun up on target and pressing the trigger, you talked about having a light switch. I'm always talking about having a flashlight. And I think just in last episode or a couple episodes ago, I talked about having my quick access safe and keeping in there my loaded gun, a spare mag, a knife, and a quality flashlight. So that always, anytime I go to grab that gun and it's low light conditions, anytime I'm grabbing the gun and I'm grabbing a light. Like that's mm-hmm. the two things that go hand in hand so that because you have to have that ability to see what it is you're shooting at. You have to.
Yep. I keep my night gun, my home defense gun has a rail light on it, has a TLR1, and I have a handheld light right next to it. We should have a podcast sometime, Riley, that's all just about the difference between or advantages between handheld lights and rail lights, by the way, like mounted lights. Anyway,
that's good.
So
good idea.
Another thought I would have had here would have been taking a position of cover, you know, because you're going to feel a lot less vulnerable if you're standing in that hallway, that entryway, whatever's near that front door. If it's just, you know, you and the target, you and the suspect, that's a very, you know, strong position of vulnerability. And I can see where you might feel more emotionally inclined to fire sooner or faster. But if you've taken a position of cover, or at least concealment, then you might feel a little bit more secure and you might feel like you have a little bit more opportunity and time to identify that target before you start shooting. So that would be another consideration is, you know, how do I take a stronger position so that I buy myself a few more seconds to identify what I'm shooting at?
Yeah. Here's another thing too, I think that must be considered, Jacob. And I'm not saying that's what happened here. It's actually not clear just by reading the story. It actually sounds like the father may have grabbed the gun in the kitchen and had been in the kitchen, you know, ready to defend himself. I mean, a lot of times you can see your front door or close to it from the kitchen or kitchen area. So I'm not saying that's necessarily what happened here, but where a lot of family members accidentally get shot in these suspected home invasion cases is when one of the family members, a homeowner, for instance, decides to go looking for the threat, right? And so why are we doing this? And I know we've talked about this before, so I'm not going to, you know, beat a dead horse here, but it's just a reminder that, you know, I think that many in our gun community probably are doing our community a disservice a lot of times by suggesting or even teaching at times. And I'm not saying, by the way, these are bad skills to have. They can have application. But, you know, like we teach building clearing to civilians sometimes, and it's like, why? You know, if the idea is that, okay, you know, in a worst case scenario, I might have to do that, fine. But if the context is, well, so that when you hear that bump in the night, you're going to go sweeping through your house, clearing rooms and clearing the house because, you know, you learned this in some class you took from your local instructor about how to clear buildings, like then we are doing a disservice to our community by, you know, encouraging gun owners and regular people, okay, that if you've got the training, that's one thing. And I'm not talking about from your local instructor. I'm talking like you got it through law enforcement or military training. I mean, then it's on you. But why are we encouraging people to go sweeping through their houses with gun in hand, looking for a threat? Yeah, isolate the family, defend the room. That's your that's your big deal, Jacob.
IFDR. Yeah. So, and for those who have no idea what the crap we're talking about, you can Google that. We have an article on our website called "Isolate the Family, Defend the Room." But episode 20 of the podcast is where we kind of hash out that concept, IFDR. But yeah, it's not unclear. Like you said, it's not clear in this news story if he, you know, chose to go position himself in the entryway or if just kind of happened to find himself there at the moment that the door was opened.
Yeah.
But yeah, to your point, you know, take my strongest position I can to defend myself and my loved ones in the home. And that's probably not in the entryway, staring at the front door, waiting for it to open. So, you know, where possible, you know, let's take our best position we can.
Yep. Agreed. Great. Next up, this is one I find very interesting for a couple reasons. First of all, the image featured in the article is of one of our instructors. Yeah, this is because a professional photographer took some photos at one of his CCW classes, and those got put up on I think they're on Getty Images actually, and a few other stock image sites. And so, you know, this instructor of ours, Damon over in Utah, is, you know, one of the most featured CCW instructors or firearms instructors on the internet. Anyway, this title here is Concealed Carry Up 215% While Murder Rate Is Down 14%. So this is fascinating. Fox News recently referenced a Crime Prevention Research Center data showing that there were 14.5 million permit holders in May 2016 and approximately 15.7 million in May 2017. Now, we've kind of shared, I think, some other things recently as well. Or I think on our site, we had maybe an article that kind of talked about that a little bit too. And so basically now we have probably more concealed carriers or CCWers than ever at any other time in history, which is really cool. I mean, we are just totally enthused here at concealedcarry.com about this. The curious thing is that nationally, the murder rate has dropped 14% during this time that permits have surged. This is not the story. This is not what gun grabbers put out there. What are they? They're always saying, hey, you know, we're putting more guns in more hands and more people. And, you know, it's just going to turn into the wild, wild west out there. But in reality, I mean, this doesn't fit the narrative, right? That's kind of what the whole idea here is, that the guns and permits have surged and violent crime has actually decreased. That seems a little bit contradictory compared to what you hear from the left a lot of times.
Yeah, and this is it's worth going and reading the actual report from the Crime Prevention Research Center, because it's actually really interesting data. But I'll be the devil's advocate on this one and say, be careful, because it is good to say that, hey, you know, because there's more guns, there's not clearly more murder. Like, okay, great, like that is important, and I'll wave that flag all day long. But I also am going to be very cautious about trying to draw a correlation between murder rate going down and concealed carry going up. Because if you look at the data really closely, it's correlation. It's not causation, at least not that they can show or prove, right? So I'm not saying let's not be excited and like screw this and dang you know, Breitbart for publishing this. I'm simply saying that let's not yell at the gun grabbers every time they try and turn correlation into causation, but then let's then us be guilty of the same mistake. So just bear in mind, this is correlation, not causation, and we should be excited about it, and it's okay to share this, but don't misread it.
Hey, stop taking the air out of my balloon, Jacob. by the way, I completely agree, and I was not saying that, hey, because permits and gun ownership has gone up, that crime has come down. I am not saying that. But what I am saying, and I'm very excited about, is that the narrative that the gun grabbers always put out there, which is guns are going up, permits are going up, crime is going to go up. Because what do they always say, Jacob? They say that people are more likely to be injured or hurt or killed when they have a gun. Right.
Yeah. No, absolutely. This definitely says that narrative isn't holding up true. It doesn't say why exactly. It's simply saying it's just not true.
Exactly. And that's why I still have air in my balloon.
you're welcome to keep that balloon inflated, my friend.
That's pretty interesting stuff there. Go check out that report, and you can, of course, as always, you'll see in the show notes of today's episode, you'll see the links to all these news stories. And when you go to that Breitbart story, there is the direct link in that story to the crime center data. Anyway, all right. this next story is also really intriguing because it's we talked about something similar in Australia a couple of months ago. We talked about something very similar, and now we're talking today about Canada. And this story is from a Canadian. This is the CBC News site, okay, cbc.ca. So a Canadian news organization site, and they're reporting that there are more than a million restricted, prohibited guns in Canada, and that number of restricted firearms rose 5.5% in 2016. So, you know, I thought, Jacob, that Canada was held up as this model for us Americans here for, you know, responsible, proper, reasonable gun control. It's the perfect model, is it not? At least that's what I've heard some people tell me.
Yeah, Canada and Australia seem to be the model, right, to follow. And it just kind of is one of those crazy things because there's never going to be a perfect model. That'd be my first thought is, you know, we can point at, you know, Canada and Australia and say, hey, you know, look how well they, well, I won't, but, you know, some people might point at them and say, look how well they've done. And there's always going to be challenges. Like, there is no perfect system here. And this is crazy awesome. Like, if by awesome, I mean the story it tells, not that it's actually a good thing. But if you go to the CBC News report and you scroll down just a little bit, look for this little bar chart, right, where it shows the total number of restricted firearms in Canada in the last 10 years, from 2005 to 2016. So I guess it's 11 years worth of data. And it's going up. it's a pretty steep curve. And the story this essentially says is outlaw something and that doesn't get rid of it. In fact, quite the opposite. In fact, outlawing it maybe temporarily makes it harder to obtain something because all the criminals have to find new methods and new systems. But that doesn't mean you can get rid of it. And in fact, perhaps the opposite. It's going to only mean there's going to be more and more of these. But the problem here is not just that the number is going up, that there's more and more of these restricted firearms. The problem is that the only people who have them now are criminals. That's where I have beef here is that, okay, great, there's more of them. That's a problem. I get it. But guess what? The only people who have them are the bad guys. That's a scary story to tell. I mean, today in America, if a criminal comes knocking on my door, and by knocking on my door, I mean that metaphorically, that may or may not actually come knocking on my door. I might meet them in a street. I might, you know, who knows where, in a parking lot. But if a criminal comes knocking on my door, I have some relative, you know, sense that I can match them in firepower legally. I mean, it's conceivable that maybe they have some, you know, NFA controlled item that I may not have, but there's nothing that I couldn't get that they're probably going to have. Well, in Canada, that's a different story. I would feel like, man, if a criminal comes knocking on my door, they might have something that is completely going to outperform, you know, that outmatches me, that I cannot rise to that occasion. They have far more firepower than I can legally have.
Yeah. Now, I do want to make sure we clarify something here that is a distinct difference. I mean, we don't often think about this probably quite in this way here in the U.S. because our gun laws are quite a bit more complicated and complex. But in Canada, they have a category that is called restricted firearms, okay, which means they are guns that can be had in Canada. But there's also a category known as prohibited firearms. Now, what is seeing the big increase is restricted firearms. And now I suspect that this probably likely means that there are criminals that are getting more of their hands on restricted firearms. But also what they are seeing are Canadians that are actually going through the process of getting these restricted firearms. They're going through all the licensing and permitting and all that is necessary to be able to have these restricted firearms. And one of the reasons that's given as to why that is the case is an increase in the popularity of target sports. And, you know, how often do we see now, Jacob, we get questions through our website quite often now, people from Canada saying, I want to get, you know, this holster, for instance, like a Brave Response holster. I live in Canada, though. Can I get a holster, this holster in Canada? And it's like, well, we don't really ship things to outside of the U.S., which is true. We just don't, as a business, we just don't ship things outside the U.S. But it's interesting because it's like, wait a minute, I thought you guys didn't really carry handguns around up in Canada. But there are some instances where you're able to do that. You just got to jump through a crap load of hoops to make it possible. So it's just interesting, right? Because here we have this so-called perfect model for reasonable and responsible gun control, which is supposedly Canada. But yet we're seeing this uptick in all these restricted guns there. And so I thought the goal with responsible and reasonable gun control was to maybe make those sorts of things go down. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's the challenge here. I mean, here's a quote, and this is speaking of prohibited guns, not just restricted ones, right? These are guns that no one can have. Let's see. The only provinces where the number of prohibited guns dropped were Ontario and Quebec, the two provinces that had the highest numbers of prohibited firearms to start with. Ontario dropped 2% and Quebec declined 0.5%. So we're not talking about huge declines, but slight declines, right? The highest increases were in the Yukon, where the number of prohibited firearms rose 6.5%, followed by British Columbia, where they rose 4.9%. I don't even know how to pronounce this province. Saskatchewan? I don't know.
Saskatchewan?
That one, sure. Was up 3.6%, while Alberta rose 3.2%. So the vast majority of these provinces are showing increases, not just in the restricted guns that Canadians are able to register and go and obtain, but they're also showing increases in prohibited guns.
Yeah. Here's another interesting quote from Mr. Bernardo, this one came from Wendy Cookier. There's two people that are quoted back-to-back in this article. And Cookier says, it's the first time in the last couple of decades that we are seeing police agencies reporting that domestically sourced firearms exceed those that are smuggled into Canada. So as you increase the legal pool of restricted weapons, including handguns and assault weapons, you create opportunities for diversion. Now, that may or may not be true as far as the diversion piece, but it's just interesting that more and more guns are being manufactured in Canada that meet these, that fall into this restricted category. Here's what I sense, Jacob, and I've heard this, just kind of in conversation with people, and I know people in Canada. In fact, a good friend of mine here locally had almost all of their family lives still in Canada, in the Calgary and up in that area, Calgary and Edmonton. That was the other city I was trying to think of. And here's what I see happening, and what I believe is happening. I believe people in Canada are becoming more and more interested in guns, and more interested in a kind of like a Second Amendment sort of right, which they don't have. I just see the interest increasing, and I wonder, are we ever going to see any change there? And I don't know. But anyway, we'll move on from this story, but I just thought it was really an interesting one. But this next one is one I couldn't wait to get to, and I find it just so baffling to me. This is a story we talked about a while back about a man. So we had a police officer in, I believe, a state patrolman in Arizona who was near Phoenix, who was being attacked by a man. Okay. Essentially, I think what happened was this officer was responding to what he thought was an accident. And when he got there, he was jumped and surprised by this attacker. And this attacker literally had the officer on the ground and was pummeling him and could have done something, obviously, to really threaten this officer's life. And a good Samaritan driving by sees what's going on. He pulls over, gets out of his vehicle. And actually, if you read this story on USA Today, he, and of course, when you see where the story is going, it doesn't surprise me now that I think about it, that this is, of course, USA Today would report something like this, because they tend to focus on gun control stories a lot. But anyway, He gets out of his car, approaches the attacker, tells him to get away. The attacker does not. He then fires and kills this man, right? So here's the story. Title is, he's a good guy with a gun who saved a cop's life, and he's for gun control.
Yeah, gun control is relative. So my first beef here is I think that the headline does not tell the story. Because Riley, what do you think when you hear the words gun control? Like if I said, hey, that's your immediate implication. You believe when you hear that someone's pro gun control, you think that they want to remove guns. They want to get less of them. Now, obviously there's varying degrees of gun control. So I'm not trying to, you know, say that all that's always the case. But certainly when someone reads a headline on USA Today, that's what you're going to believe. And I kind of think it's funny because I suspect there's a lot of gun grabbers out there that would see this and like start sharing it on social. And then when people come and read it, they'd actually see that it's not actually totally the story. Now, this guy does support some legislation that most of us would refer to as gun control type legislation, but he's not pro disarmament or confiscation.
That is correct. At least I believe so. I mean, it says right here in the story, it says Yoxel, that's the man's name. What was his first name again? Thomas Yoxel. He believes that, quoting from the story, he believes that. And what that is, he believes that upstanding individuals should be armed, which, you know, he was able to end the situation that threatened this cop's life because he was armed. He believes in that, he says. He also believes ownership should be restricted. Part of that comes from his knowledge that guns are not always used for good. And then it talks about how he's been on the wrong end of a gun. You know, when he was younger, he was probably, you know, talked about him, his hellion days, his youthful hellion days. So obviously he had a colorful past, and it put him in some situations where he may have come in contact with and ended up on the wrong end of a gun before. He even talks about how he could have, probably used deadly force in a justified manner in certain situations in the past in his life, but he was unable to do so. So he had a reason actually to carry a gun, and he was doing so legally, and he was able to actually use that to good effect to save this cop's life. But he also believes ownership should be restricted. Now, I also personally believe that most Americans do believe in some restriction. In fact, the Supreme Court and a lot of case law actually supports some restriction of the Second Amendment. But I just find this interesting that we find this story that talks about how this man who used a gun to save a cop's life is also for gun control. And I have to ask the question, can you have your cake and eat it too?
Well, you know, if you get specific, and this, the article is extraordinarily specific in describing this man's life and his background and what he's done and where he's come from, but it's horribly vague at talking about what kind of gun control he actually supports. And the best I was able to derive from reading this is he says he supports responsible gun ownership and he backs mandated training and background checks. So if you know, from what I can derive from this entire article that supposedly he's pro-gun control, what that actually means is that he's behind the idea of mandated training and background checks. But he supports responsible gun ownership. So here's I think, my take on this, because Riley, I think your question is a valid one. And I think, actually, I'm going to say yes, so to speak. And I'll tell you why I'm going to answer your question that way, and you may not like it. But I think that we all have the right to personally interpret what we think something means. We all read the Second Amendment, and everyone listening to this podcast is probably a pro Second Amendment person, meaning we support to some degree, however we define it, the right to keep and bear arms. But how I define that and how you define it, Riley, and how one of our listeners may define that is going to vary. And, you know, we certainly know that we have tons of listeners and readers and, you know, customers who are essentially what I would call like unrestricted, you know, type of philosophy people where, hey, the Second Amendment means like anything I want to do, I can do it. And it shouldn't be restricted at all because it says, you know, not restricted right in the amendment. Okay, like that's fine. Like I completely respect your right to interpret it that way. But if I have a student come through my class who says, hey, I think that background checks are fine and that people should have to get a background check to get a gun, and I support that, I don't immediately say, well, you're a gun grabber. Like, we shouldn't even let you own guns. I just have to respect that that's their opinion, and that that's how they interpret the Second Amendment. And they think that, that is a reasonable restriction placed by the court system or by the legislature on a constitutional right that we've been given. In the same way that, I think it's reasonable that someone can't walk onto a plane and shout bomb. You know, that we restrict their right to freedom of speech in that regard. That doesn't mean I have to agree with them. It just means I have to respect that that's how they feel about it, and that that's how they interpret that right to be applied and to be restricted. So I guess what I'm saying is, can you have your cake and eat it too, or whatever your question was? The answer is, to some degree, it's okay. We have to respect all gun owners who believe in the Second Amendment, even if they don't understand it the same way we do, or if they feel differently about how it should be restricted than we do. And we can have good, valuable, constructive conversations about that, but that doesn't mean that we hate them now.
Yeah. So, good. I think those are fair thoughts. And we've hashed this out, episode 50, where we talked about should training be required. And definitely, I mean, Jacob, you and I see completely eye to eye as far as people. You should, like, we should get trained. We should spend time training. We should spend money on training. We should make sure that we are as prepared as we possibly can be to use a gun in self-defense if necessary, and to make sure that we're safe in handling those guns. Where I struggle a little bit, obviously, is I don't necessarily believe the government should mandate that training is required. I think that we should seek it out for ourselves. I don't like the government getting in my business and telling me what I got to do, right? Now, we've hashed that out before. Now, it certainly is, I think, reasonable to we've already made this point, that this guy can, be all the things that he is. And it even talks in his article about all the training he's gone through, which I think is great. And it obviously paid off for him in the situation where he had to save this cop's life. But I don't know that I would completely agree with him on some of his points, and that's okay. But here's something I did find interesting. It said that when this incident happened, where he came upon the scene, where he had to shoot the bad guy, they were on their way to Anaheim, California, to Disneyland. And the gun used is a Springfield Armory XD9.
I missed that.
So I'm thinking,
oh, that's funny.
Was that legal to be taking that handgun with you to California? I'm not gonna go any further than that. I just found that interesting. But there are some really cool, I don't know if I should say cool, but I love details about stories. And when that story was first reported, there was, as many times, because there's an investigation that's got to take place and things, there was not a lot of details. And it actually talks about how he, ran up there. He saw a woman's body on the ground, and he remembers thinking, not a threat. Okay. All right. He was looking around, and he realized there's a body, there's a person there. They are not a threat. Move on. And he gets up and he sees the man on top of the cop pummeling him. He tells him to get off of him. And when the man didn't, he describes right here, he raises his arms up to pummel him. That's when Yoxel squeezed the trigger. Pop, pop, pop. Three times. The third shot hit the man's head, killing him. Wow. That's the reality of it, right? And we should be aware of that and be ready. I mean, like, that's what can and will happen sometimes in some of these situations. And, that's not an easy thing to do, but it's sometimes the necessary thing, at least if you're going to, save somebody's life like he did in this situation. A life-changing event for sure. So,
one last thought, sorry, Riley, that I just wanted to point out. And it's a bit of a tangent on kind of what we've been focusing on here, but I do think it's interesting. And essentially, what I found interesting is that he said that he was really surprised, and I am too, that dozens of cars drove by that incident and no one called 911.
Yeah.
So, they kind of make this correlation to the Good Samaritan story in the Bible, where they basically said, how many people passed this incident, this officer getting beat down, and did nothing. They just kept driving. They didn't even call 911, let alone stop. And I just, thought that was an interesting, take on this as well.
Yep. Well, there you go. Interesting story, to say the least. Two remaining stories, both justified stories, so we are now into our justified segment, and we better start wrapping it up, because we're already at an hour. First up, Las Vegas man kills knife-wielding intruder in self-defense. Take it away, Jacob.
Okay, so a bad dude, unnamed man, broke into the gun owner's apartment at around 6:30 in the morning on Tuesday, May 23rd. It's not yet known the intentions of the man, but he did have a knife. The apartment's resident feared for his life enough to pull out his gun, and once he met face-to-face with the invader, he pulled the trigger. His shot hit the target directly in the heart, killing him. So, not a lot of detail here, but clearly the knife wielder broke into an apartment, and the apartment, you know, resident shot and killed him.
That's pretty much how it went down. So,
yeah, as far as I'm concerned, I mean... What we don't know is, you know, were any verbal commands given? We don't know how much time was there. But I will say this about apartments. Apartments, you have no potential escape a lot of those times, especially if you're on a second, third, fourth story. You're kind of stuck. You're literally backed into a corner. And you were probably even more inclined than some others to have to defend yourself. I mean, have to. And so in that regard, that is what it is. And I say, you know, good prevailed.
Yeah. So an intruder with a knife, and you know what they say, Jacob, about knives and gunfights?
That's right. Yeah, he did not come prepared.
So, there you have it. I mean, that's what this is all about. I really enjoy these justified stories that we share each week because it's so refreshing, you know, especially when we see the media so often attacking normal, everyday, law-abiding citizens' rights to have guns. And it's like, we can always... I mean, I talked about this. In fact, last week, I didn't mention this in another episode, but last week I was interviewed on the Bolo podcast, which another podcast, you can go check it out, Bolo. So be on the lookout for it. It's a law enforcement-focused kind of fitness podcast. And they wanted to interview me and talk about what we're doing here at concealedcarry.com. And we were talking about the Brave Response holster as well, which is the thing that we sell so many of. And I kind of touched on this in that interview with Mike over there at the Bolo podcast about we study these, we make it a point to every week we see these justified stories. We share them in our podcast. And we know these are popular because you all, our listeners, our fans refer to them. We get great responses to these stories. And it's so refreshing to be able to counter the gun grabbers and anti-gunners arguments as far as, you know, they want to say. There was a story I just saw reported the other day about how, you know, it was on some site. It was an opinion piece, you know, talking about how someone that's just being raped shouldn't, necessarily have the ability or the reason to be able to use a gun or carry a gun simply for the purpose of protecting themselves from rape. And it's like, really? What? Excuse me? You know? I mean, we can point at these stories where people legally stop attacks on themselves, on their homes, on their families, and on themselves. And they do so successfully on a daily basis in this country. There's a reason we have this right. There's a reason we should have this right, because I believe it is a fundamental, basic human right for us to be able to defend ourselves. And the best tool to defend ourselves with is with a gun, as these justified stories prove time and time again. So this final one, I think, it's very similar to this one we just shared in more ways than one. This comes to us from Stockbridge, Georgia, reported on WTOC, local, it's the Channel 11 affiliate there in the area. And the title is Man Suspected of Armed Robbery at Dollar General Killed During Home Invasion. A home invasion.
Yes. Oh, go ahead.
Okay. A home invasion suspect who was also suspected of robbing a Dollar General was killed by a homeowner. Robert McDonald, age 26, held a knife to an employee of a Dollar General in Stockbridge while demanding money. The suspect fled the scene after jumping onto the bed of a truck that was waiting for him outside. He then jumped from the truck when officers attempted to stop the vehicle. So while officers are then investigating the armed robbery, patrol officers were dispatched to a home invasion on Kinsey Drive, it says here. According to police, the suspect matched the description of McDonald. The homeowner told officers he heard glass break inside the home, and the suspect entered the home a short while later. The homeowner made contact with the suspect and said the suspect approached him in a threatening manner. The homeowner grabbed his gun from behind the door, pointed it at the suspect, yelled for help. The homeowner's father heard his son, came down the stairs with a gun, and shot the suspect in the chest, killing him.
Like father, like son. I that was the thing I thought was so interesting, is that you have homeowner grab gun, point at suspect, but not fire. But instead, he just yells for help. And then dad comes down. In my mind, I'm assuming it's an elderly dad since the son is a homeowner. So elderly dad comes, you know, grandpa comes down the stairs with his own gun, and he fires and shoots the suspect.
Yeah, so it was a team effort.
Yeah. I don't mean to, like son.
I don't mean to laugh. Armed. I'm sorry, but you know what I mean. This is a challenge too, because here we share these stories each week, and they're grim, gruesome, sad stories. Really, like it's sad that people are even at a point in their lives where they're willing to take the risk of attacking people and breaking into homes and carjacking people and stuff. But I relish in the joy, and it's not like joy about killing people. It's joy that Americans are able to defend themselves. And to tie it back in with today's theme, which is it's Memorial Day, I relish in the joy that we have men and women, soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines that have fought and died and bled and cried so that we have this right here in this country. And I relish in the joy that we are able to defend ourselves.
Yeah, I would just, you know, reiterate what you said about Memorial Day and people who, you know, fight to help keep us safe. And obviously Memorial Day is focused on our soldiers, right? Our troops, our, you know, enrolled military. But I would go also a little further and say, you know, all of us are doing something to fight evil, you know, from my kids' school teachers to, you know, moms, all moms. And I'd like to believe that, you know, the listener to this podcast is doing something to fight evil and to make our country safer. So while Memorial Day, we're really celebrating, you know, the people who are in uniform, I would just also say thank you to everybody who's doing their part.
Right on. Let's wrap it up. Today's episode is brought to you by Guardian Nation. Looking for more training and better gear? Join Guardian Nation today to be part of the fastest growing tribe of self-defense-minded shooters nationwide. Access our concealedcarry.com shooter skill library, our Guardian Nation live broadcasts that we do each month, and our archive of those broadcasts, as well as 10% off everything sold at concealedcarry.com. Plus, each quarter, get the Guardian Gear Box. You want the Guardian Gear Box, I promise you. We've been putting some awesome stuff in there, and we got awesome stuff coming. So get your dues returned to you in gear every 3 months. Join today. Go check it out at guardiannation.com. And today's episode is also brought to you by Mantis X. You've been hearing us talk about this quite a bit lately. We've been fans of it for some time now, but more and more of our instructors in our network are getting these and using them and finding out these are awesome. And we've heard back from even customers of Mantis X that just love what it does for them, as far as it's like almost like having an instructor in their pocket. As all you got to do is attach Mantis X to your firearm. It connects via Bluetooth to your wireless device like your phone, and you can literally watch as shots are being fired and see the movement in your gun at the time that you're shooting those shots. Get that real-time data sent back to your mobile phone, analyze it, find out where your deficiencies lie, and then fix them. Mantis X will literally, I mean, it'll be your new best friend, I think, as far as firearm training device. Check out the review that we did and watch a video about it and how it works and what it does for you. And go check that out at concealedcarry.com/MantisX, MantisX. And so with that, oh, and by the way, on our next episode of the Concealed Carry Podcast, so this Wednesday's episode, I'm going to get Matthew Marister back for a part two of the episode we were doing last week, which was, is your holster dangerous? So we did part one, we'll do part two. Join us then. Hope that you enjoy. I think it'll be a good one. So with that, Jacob, I'm going to say goodbye. How about you?
Yeah, goodbye.
Thank goodness. Get out of my face, man. All right, listeners, thanks so much. We appreciate all the support you give us. We thank you for following us and liking us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Please, if you haven't done those already, we hope that you would go find us and follow us and converse with us there. And so with that, enjoy your Memorial Day and the start of another work week on Tuesday. Although I'm sorry if you're working if you're working today, I'm also sorry for that, but I hope you enjoy it. Take care, be safe, train hard. We will see you Wednesday.
Reminder that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand applicable laws. The Concealed Carry Podcast, Concealed Carry Inc., ConcealedCarry.com, and their affiliates strive to share insights and stories about firearm-related incidents and laws, but things could be different where you live, or laws may have changed by the time you listen to this. We cannot be held liable for your actions based on the information shared in this podcast.